This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, November 23rd, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway will be held on Thursday, December 15th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. This drawing is your chance to win a gift from one of many KUAF underwriters and program sponsors. Participants include Dog Party USA, Urban Jungle, Pack Rat Outdoor Center, and Ozark Natural Foods. Registration and more information are available on the web at KUAF.com.
Earlier this fall, two of the country's foremost scholars on the First Amendment came to Fayetteville as part of the University of Arkansas's Hartman Hotz Lecture Series in Law and Liberal Arts. Robert Post, the dean of the Yale Law School, and Frederick Schauer, the former dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, delivered a talk on the First Amendment and academic freedom. A few hours before that discussion, they sat down inside an office at the University of Arkansas School of Law. Robert Post says the 45-word text of the First Amendment remains a major source of passionate debate and argument more than 200 years after it was written.
The amendment is very simple, but of course it applies to the freedom of speech. And everything we do is through speech. Montaigne used to say, you know, we're human, so we relate to each other through speech. So if you take that literally, it would apply to everything and anything that we do vis-a-vis other human beings, because we become human because we communicate. So the first task of thinking about the amendment is to think where it should and shouldn't apply. That's got to be task number one, is to simplify it and describe with some degree of precision the occasions when you want to bring the full force of the Constitution to bear.
And it is interesting, given the way you introduce the subject, much of the rest of the world thinks that the U.S. is obsessed with this. That is, there's certainly some form of freedom of expression or freedom of communication protection in every open democracy in the world. But the U.S.'s degree of protection is vastly greater than anywhere else in the world, including any of the other liberal democracies. Most other countries think that we come out far too heavily on the side of freedom of speech and freedom of the press at the expense of other things. The Canadians, for example, think equality is just as important, and in conflict between speech and equality, equality ought to win more than it does. The Germans feel the same way about dignity. The French feel that way about privacy and a whole bunch of other things. So it's an important topic in the U.S., but also the importance of it in the U.S. is an important topic.
You mentioned that other countries think we're obsessed. All you have to do is turn on the 24-hour cable news cycle, and you can see that we're obsessed, whether it's Tea Party activists, Occupy Wall Street, Hank Williams Jr. You cannot go a day, it seems, without a public discussion about either freedom of speech or the importance of freedom of speech.
It is universal, and it is an interesting question how much of that comes from the fact that it's enshrined in a constitution that's now 200 and some years old, how much of that is a function of it being a formative part of the revolutionary experience, how much of it is a function of a whole bunch of other things. But it's the argument of choice. There is a, both in law and in public debate, as you mentioned, a degree of what we might call First Amendment opportunism. If you have an argument, you want to hook it onto the First Amendment, in much the same way that, again, the Canadians, if you have an argument, you want to hook it onto equality. And in other countries, you want to hook your argument onto something. The opportunism in the U.S. is that the iconic First Amendment, the iconography of free speech and free press is something that everybody wants to use, regardless of whether their arguments are intrinsically at the core of free speech ideas or not.
Yeah, I think Fred has it absolutely right. One hypothesis about why it's true in the United States that we're so obsessed with freedom of speech is speech is the political liberty par excellence. And you need a political liberty when you distrust the government. I just came from teaching in Germany. And they have a constitution, and it guarantees freedom of expression. It actually also guarantees freedom of academic freedom, and so on. But they give much less freedom of speech than in the United States, as Fred observed. But that corresponds with a much greater trust in the government. So in Europe, where you can have a good deal of your economy regulated out of Brussels with a great deal of democratic deficit, the population seems to accept that. In the United States, where we see black helicopters hovering over every distant horizon, where the government is always facing a crisis of legitimacy, where the population runs against Washington every time you have an election, you need something that ties the government to the people. And the ecology in the United States of political legitimacy is such that we appeal to the right of freedom of expression because we think by speaking we'll make the government hear us and be responsive to us. And we have a great need to do that, much more than in most countries in the world, certainly much more than in Canada, say, or Australia, or any of the European countries.
Or even more than countries who have far less reason to trust their governments than we do ours. That is, there have been some number of political scientists have done some pretty serious cross-country comparisons on trust in government. And the U.S. and occasionally Australia are always at or near the top of the list of do you distrust your government? Above, with some frequency, the Zimbabwes and the North Koreas and the like of the world. And maybe it's because of the revolutionary experience. Maybe it's because of the immigrant experience for many of us, probably a vast majority of Americans. Our ancestors came here because they didn't like the governments where they were, so we are disproportionately populated by government distrusters and their descendants. And it's possible that the obsession with free speech and free press is merely a manifestation of an even larger distrust of government generally, as we're seeing these days with the Tea Party and the like.
It just seems counterintuitive that if we embrace freedom of speech, that we'd be high on the list of distrust of government.
We want speech because we need something to make the government answerable to us. We want speech because we distrust the government. It's a way of bringing the government into line with our wishes. If we think we can speak, then the government maybe will hear us. There's less of a need for freedom of speech if you just trust what the government is doing. You know, we don't see until very recently protests against very arcane boards of expertise like the Fed, you know, until we have an economic crisis, then suddenly it becomes political. But before that, you know, if you basically trust that the experts will do what they're doing, you don't need freedom of speech to say, listen to me, you're getting it wrong, you're not understanding what's happening on Main Street. And in most countries in the world, they regard government the way we would have regarded the Fed, say, in 1995 or something like that.
And therefore, in most countries, there's more trust in government, broadly speaking, to draw the distinctions that any form of speech regulation would require. So, for example, it would be unthinkable in the U.S. to make it to make Holocaust denial a crime. Most of Western Europe and Canada and many other countries are quite comfortable saying this is not a problem. We trust the government to decide, at least at the extreme, what's true and what's false, what are good ideas, what are harmful ideas. The ability to sanction people for going over the line is a function of trust in those who would administer the sanctions. And that trust doesn't exist here in ways that it does in other places. So in France, for example, which probably among Western European countries has the greatest degree of legal regulation of hate speech, former actress, current animal activist Brigitte Bardot has been fined and otherwise sanctioned for her anti-Islamic statements. Jean Le Pen, who the far-right politician who nevertheless is headed or was head of a party that gets 15% of the vote, has been sanctioned for essentially saying that you know, the Holocaust happened, but it wasn't that big a deal, and things of this sort that would never happen here.
So another, I think Fred is 150% accurate in what he says. Another way to see this is you have a trust in government to draw the line. So the line is you can say this, but to say that would be to go too far and to engage in hate speech or something. You have to have trust in where the line is drawn. So where does the government draw the line? Who is the government when it draws the line? So in part because of the history of the absolute monarchies in Europe, because of the history of absolute government, democracy is a relatively recent invention. People in Europe were subjects of the state, not citizens, and so forth and so on. So you would trust the state. But even more deeply, the question would be, who's the state? And in countries like Canada and France and Germany, there are elite strata of the population. And as a social matter, there's great trust in the hegemony of certain elite stratas of the population that know what's best. In the United States, we have a free-for-all that among social strata. Populism in the United States is strong and well precisely because the lower classes refuse to know their place. They're always rising up in resentment. And if you think of a model for that constitutionally, the best example would be our Establishment Clause. So we don't allow for the establishment of religion. That wasn't because the founding generation was a religious or atheist, far from it. It was rather because we had so many different competing Protestant sects. We had Baptists and Methodists and Episcopalians and Congregationalists and Presbyterians. They were each afraid that the national government would come under the dominion of one or the other, so they made a treaty. They said no one sect could control the resources of the federal government. Freedom of speech is a little bit the same. Because our social classes, as well as the distrust of the state, our social classes regard each other with such distrust, we don't trust any particular class to have hegemony, and we use the First Amendment to say no class gets to draw the line, say this goes too far. This is uncivil to say this, because to say uncivil is to say my rules of civility are the one that defines who gets to be at the table.
One area in which this plays out, it goes back to what Robert was saying at the beginning about trying to figure out which forms of speech in the literal sense have something to do with the First Amendment and which ones have nothing to do with it. Much of this plays out in the degree of trust or distrust of administrative agencies. So although there are lots of people who traditionally would distrust the government to decide which political ideas are right or wrong, traditionally, we've trusted the Federal Trade Commission to decide, for example, that advertisements for diet slippers and diet earrings, I am not making this up, are so preposterously false that they can be sanctioned. The Food and Drug Administration, in its labeling requirements, does much the same thing. The Securities and Exchange Commission does much the same thing in requiring registration before you sell securities. I wonder whether in the recent last 3 or 4 years, even more extreme anti-government sentiment, whether this is spilling over into a sentiment in opposition to even expert administrative agencies. The Federal Reserve used to be in that esteem and no longer is. And whether at some point, at least some people will worry that the Securities and Exchange Commission, the FTC, the FDA, and the like can't be trusted to decide what's true and what's false, even in the realm of fact and even in the realm of science.
Just to build on what Fred is saying, this distrust of government expertise, agency expertise, is, of course, built into the right wing of the Republican Party. And we now have many justices on the U.S. Supreme Court who come out of that wing of the party. And it's quite apparent that they're increasing First Amendment protections for commercial speech because they don't trust the expert judgments of the agencies. And they imagine striking down regulations of deceptive speech or regulations of commercial interactions, which, of course, all occur through speech. They imagine that as part of a libertarian agenda of reducing government regulation altogether. And one of the reasons that they pursue this agenda is because they don't trust in the neutral expertise of government.
So Robert touches on one of the most fascinating dimensions of the free speech culture in the last 10 to 15 years, a huge change in its political incidence. When people of our age were coming of academic or legal age. Free speech was the argument on behalf of communists, socialists, anti-Vietnam War protesters,
pornographers.
Civil pornographers, civil rights demonstrators, and so on. It was, by and large, the argument of the left. More recently, all of the things that Robert was talking about regulation of commercial advertising, combined with opposition to so-called political correctness, combined with opposition to the feminist anti-pornography movement, combined with perhaps most saliently the debates about campaign finance regulation. Increasingly, there's been a huge shift, and that as often, if not more, the strong free speech position is on what might loosely be called the political right rather than the political left.
Robert Post, the dean of the Yale Law School, and Frederick Schauer, the former dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, visited the University of Arkansas campus this fall.
Their public discussion involved academic freedom and the First Amendment, and they discussed that topic before their public lecture as well. We'll hear that and more ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. We continue now with our conversation with Robert Post and Frederick Schauer, recorded at the University of Arkansas School of Law, when both men were here late last month to discuss the First Amendment and academic freedom as part of the Hartman Hotz Lecture Series in Law and Liberal Arts at the University of Arkansas. Earlier in the conversation, the men had used the example of Holocaust deniers and freedom in other countries. I return to that example for the next part of our discussion.
If I wanted to deny the Holocaust, and I went down to the corner here, and I could do that, I would get strange looks, perhaps a fist to the nose, but I could do that. If I go back to the public radio station I work for and do that, I'd have the pink slip in my hand within an hour. If I'm a professor on a campus, can I do that?
When we're talking about speech, typically in the United States, and the protection of speech, we're talking about speech which is part of the formation of public opinion. It's extreme. A democracy is a form of government in which the government, the state, is answerable to public opinion. And the forms of speech acts which create public opinion are typically the ones that the First Amendment, when you think of a paradigmatic First Amendment case, protects. And it's a very complicated thing, what public opinion is as opposed to private opinion. But however you think about that issue, the boundary issue, what we do is we discuss what to do in public. There's a public opinion. The state responds to public opinion by trying to do something. It makes a decision. It wants to create a Social Security Administration or something else. So in order to accomplish a goal in the modern world, you have to create an organization. An organization is an arrangement of people and resources dedicated to a mission, to an objective. Hand out Social Security checks or defend the country in the military or dispense justice with the courts. Organizations are purposely defined. They're subject to means ends or instrumental reasoning. Right? When you govern in an organization, you have to arrange people and resources to accomplish the goal of the mission. That means you have to be able to regulate their speech so as to accomplish the mission of the organization. So if I'm in the Social Security Administration and my subordinate is supposed to be handing out checks and instead decides to stand on his desk and make a speech, whether it's denying or anything, it's just not doing their job, that's a problem, right? So within these governmental organizations, the regulation of speech looks and feels completely different than it does than when you stand on the corner and deny the Holocaust. Because when you're standing on the corner, you're addressing the public, which is to say strangers, people you don't know, and it's presumably an effort to change public opinion. But when you're working in your job is to do whatever the mission is of public radio, and they can regulate your speech so as to attain their job, whatever that is. And that gets into another set of questions.
And if what in technical terms for First Amendment specialists is called content regulation or viewpoint regulation, pervades our jobs. I can go out, and any of my students can go out on the street and say, in my opinion, the Constitution of the United States has 39 amendments and was first adopted in 1883 as part of a communist conspiracy. They can say all of that. If they put that on one of my exams, I, as an official of the Commonwealth of Virginia, am going to sanction them for it. So, too, when, at least in the context of state universities, like here, like mine, that we routinely make tenure and promotion decisions about our colleagues, we take into account not only the content of what they write, but, to put it bluntly, the truth and falsity of what they write. And we can't imagine that it would be otherwise. Balancing that line, being able to say to my junior colleagues, we want you to go where your mind takes you, but at some point we're going to evaluate you on whether your mind has taken you to places that are either ridiculous or even unoriginal, and that will hurt you.
Right. So, I mean, to take this to the subject of academic freedom is the freedom that applies to, say, professors at a university. And often, if Fred or I would ask our colleagues, what's your academic freedom, the answer would be, it's the First Amendment right. But what Fred just said demonstrates, I think, that it's completely incompatible with the First Amendment right. A First Amendment right is the right to assert your opinion, which is why we say in the First Amendment there's no such thing as a false idea. The state can't judge the truth or falsity of your opinions when you're trying to shape public opinion. But that's precisely opinion. When you're in an organization like the university and your job is to create knowledge or to communicate knowledge, you are judged by your competence at that mission. And competence is not just a matter of having an opinion. It's a matter of having a competent opinion. And throughout universities, we judge people on their competence, the competencies of their opinion. So you have somebody who's an astronomer, and he writes an editorial in the New York Times, says, I've just made this great discovery. The moon is made of green cheese. Nothing happens. But he wants to get tenure based on that, doesn't get tenure. So the right of academic freedom is the right not to be able to say your opinion, which is a First Amendment right, an individual right, a subjective right. The right of academic freedom is the right to be judged on your competency and not by criteria which are irrelevant to your competency, like my academic judgment that evolution is actually a scientific fact happens to offend the people of the state of Arkansas who believe in creationism. The belief, the popular belief, can't be used to judge the competency of my expert opinion about evolution. That's the essence of academic freedom.
Do you have a gauge of the quotient, the First Amendment quotient, of either the American public or the American press? Well, how much we know, how much we are knowledgeable? Because we all have a gut feeling. We can all yell about it.
There are two very different issues here. Let me take the, very briefly in reverse order. It's interesting that you mentioned the press. Of course, the press is hardly a disinterested observer of controversies about free speech and free press. And therefore, in many areas, the press makes free press and free speech claims that are even more aggressive than existing doctrine would say. Many of the claims, for example, about reporters' privileges, which are important claims, go considerably beyond where even American law is now. So I don't think there's a little bit of a knowledge problem with respect to the press, but it's more of a advocacy position that the press has. With respect to the public, there's a lot of abstract support for free speech. There's very little support, and lots of surveys have reported this, for speech of things that are in particular wrong, perceived to be wrong, or perceived to be dangerous. I'll give one example. Back in the late 1980s, the Supreme Court, in a case called Texas versus Johnson, upheld the right of a man named Gregory Lee Johnson to burn the American flag. And for at least the majority of the Supreme Court, this was not a particularly difficult case. Almost immediately thereafter, Congress, which has a much better sense of the feelings of the American public than I do, passed a law almost identical to the one that the Supreme Court had struck down by a vote of more or less 460-30, or between the two houses, something like that. The Supreme Court then struck that one down a year later. But the flag-burning controversy is a reasonably good indication of the fact that once we are talking about speech that is perceived to be or is extreme, dangerous, dead wrong, or whatever, the courts are way, way out ahead of where the American public has been or will ever be.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I mean, if you look at the history of free speech doctrine, it used to be up until 1964 that the press always wanted to go to a jury. I mean, the great history of liberty of press from Fox's Libel Act in the 18th century is we want to take it away from the executive, from judges, and we want to give it to the people because they will understand freedom of press. And freedom of press was understood as the liberty of the people vis-a-vis the state, vis-a-vis the king, vis-a-vis the judges, etc. At the beginning of our modern era of First Amendment doctrine is a case called New York Times versus Sullivan. And it basically said, I will have liberty to defame you, which means to say nasty things about you that will reduce the esteem in which you are held in your community. And for most people, it's very counterintuitive that people should be able to talk in ways like that, which are quite damaging to people's reputation and to your sense of self. And yet the court said, if we're going to have free public discourse, we can't be guided by the community norm of what is damaging and what's civil and what's not civil. So the sociological formation of the public overrode the community norms by which you and I live most of our lives. It's actually quite naked and exposed to be out in public where we're stripped of the normal protections that we have among our friends, among the community of people who share our norms and so on, who have the tacit understandings that we understand as respect and dignity and so forth. In the public, people just get to talk about you. And it's, you know, if you've ever been there, if you've ever been exposed to public comment, it's extremely vulnerable making. So ever since that moment, from 1964 on, the press is always seeking to get the decision by a judge who's an expert in this First Amendment law rather than the jury, because the jury will hang them. Because the jury is enforcing local norms, which are how most Americans... Now, that's been, I would say, the dynamic now for 50 years. Yeah. But it's also the case that if you ask the American public, they demand and they sit on their First Amendment rights. They just don't have much of a clue of what it is.
Especially since a disproportionate number of the most prominent claimants of free speech cases have been pretty distasteful people. So we have the Klan, we have the Nazis, we have flag burners.
Crusher movie makers.
We have makers of animal cruelty. Crush movies.
Larry Flint.
We have Larry Flint, we have child pornographers. The most of the prominent claimants of free speech rights, and most of the people who have been formative in creating this exceptional American tradition have been pretty distasteful people with pretty distasteful things to say. And there's a real question whether that ever would have happened without, as Robert said, essentially the courts being at the forefront of this.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Post, the dean of the Yale Law School, and Frederick Schauer, the former dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, were on the University of Arkansas campus in late October as part of the Hartman Hotz Lecture Series on Law and Liberal Arts. The University of Arkansas Hartman Hotz Lectures in Law and Liberal Arts were established by Dr. and Mrs. Palmer Hotz of Foster City, California, to honor the memory of his brother Hartman Hotz. Hartman Hotz was a graduate in history from the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large and KUAF, supported by Pays Interactive, offering custom interactive development and design for businesses of all sizes with a focus on clients and their individual needs. Information available at paysinteractive.com or 439-0291.
It It's Wednesday, November 23rd, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. Joining us now is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor, Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Oddly enough, there's not a lot going on today.
On Thanksgiving Eve?
Yeah, oddly enough. I guess people are going to cook. On the other hand, if you need an afternoon outing, the Eagle Watch tours are back on Beaver Lake, sponsored by Hobbs State Park Conservation Area. Today's is at 3 o'clock at the Rocky Branch Marina. Tickets are $10 for adults, $5 for children. You need to call 789-5000 for reservations. Even if you don't see a single eagle, it's still so much fun. And I think Flip Putoff is leading today's tour.
Is he?
So.
Did you ever get to go on one of those?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we went when it was blisteringly
cold. Right?
Cold.
Okay, that's what
I looked like the Michelin man, and we got on the boat, and the boat wouldn't start. So then we went on another lovely warm, I think it was in February, a lovely warm day, and the people I was with saw eagles. I had my eyes closed basking in the sun, so if there were eagles, I missed them.
Well, that's okay. So note to listeners, keep your eyes open.
Exactly.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Earth, sky.
Today, Ken Kassman at the University of Nebraska on the subject of water for food. Kassman is a professor of agronomy, the science of soil management and crop production. He said that more than two-thirds of the water humans use today is used to produce food. So Dr. Kassman asked, how can we grow even more food for the greater numbers of people expected on Earth in this 21st century using the same or less water than we're using today? Dr. Kassman said irrigation will be a big part of the answer.
The importance of irrigated agriculture is only going to increase because we only have so much good arable land with suitable soil. And because we don't want to expand agriculture into the last remaining rainforests and wetlands.
Kassman said he expects irrigation practices to change dramatically.
At a large scale, we can think of systems that are completely integrated with real-time satellite image data so that we're matching the supply of water precisely in time and space with the need of every plant on a large field.
But, he said, irrigated agriculture has to be sustainable.
But we have to do it in a way that it protects water resources and protects water quality at the same time. If you put that challenge before talented young scientists, I guarantee it can be done.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. 40 years ago, Frances Moore LePay wrote the book Diet for a Small Planet. She wrote in 1971 that a plant-based diet could ease world hunger, an unconventional idea for many at that time. The book sold more than 3 million copies. Now she's written a new book, EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. The book argues that humans have solutions to problems like climate change and a growing financial crisis, but our way of thinking about issues has left us powerless. Recently, Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas talked to her about her latest book and about her first one, 40 years old this year, that advocated for a vegetarian diet.
I grew up in Fort Worth, you know, Cowtown, and no, people really thought you couldn't live without meat in 1971. Most people really thought that you'd get sick and you'd die of protein deficiency or something, you know. In fact, I used to joke that one of the things that Diet for a Small Planet achieved is relieving the terror of parents whose kids were turning vegetarian and they were so worried about them, and my book helped to put their mind at ease.
Well, how did you react to the skepticism?
And maybe I say this in the book. I haven't reread it in a long time, but, you know, I felt like the little boy in the fairy tale who says the emperor wears no clothes, because what I was writing was, you know, it was so obvious, and yet nobody was saying it. So I kept thinking, wait, did I get a decimal point wrong or something? I mean, this is all so obvious. And why isn't everybody saying it? And then over the decades now, and it certainly fits in with the theme of my new book, is that human beings see what we expect to see, and if something doesn't fit within our, now what I call our mental map, then we don't see it, even if it is right in front of our noses. So, you know, I was just so stunned at what I was finding that was so out of line with what the experts were telling us, you know, that we'd run out of food. And so it was more that shock of being right, in a sense, like, wait a minute, I'm just a kid in the library, and why am I able to see this? And I think it, and now, of course, I say often to young people that really the value of the beginner's eyes, you know, the value of someone approaching a topic without the preconceived notion is critical. So I say to young people, never underestimate the power of the beginner's eyes.
I saw on your website that Steve Jobs, who recently passed away, found that book very influential.
Yeah.
How does it feel to have influenced somebody who has been so influential?
Oh, well, I was delighted. I was totally delighted. Steve Jobs, you know, I think, you know, he was part of that generation, and I know people who knew him as a young man, and so I was sort of aware that he was part of, what we would call then the counterculture when he began. And so I wasn't that surprised, I guess, that he was aware of the book, but I was delighted that he singled it out as something. That was really surprised, that he singled it out as a book that really had a huge impact on his life choices. So, it feels very good. And somehow, you know, to me, this is the big year. It's been a very emotional year, in a way, you know, marking the 40th anniversary at the same time that I'm publishing EcoMind. I see EcoMind as a direct descendant of A Diet for Small Planet and kind of the bookends of my life right now. Mm-hmm. And just feels very, very special then to have acknowledgement of Steve Jobs.
You mentioned that Diet for a Small Planet was a reaction to hearing that there was a lack of food, that we had too many, you know, our population had grown and there wasn't enough food. What, is there a specific headline or event that EcoMind is a reaction to?
Yes. I begin the book with a description of my own feelings as I left a big conference on global problems a few years ago in Washington, D.C., and many of my heroes spoke, and I was actually, I guess, next to the last speaker or something. There were dozens of speakers, and, you know, we started out with hundreds of people in the auditorium, and by the end, it had dwindled quite a bit. And I walked out, you know, feeling like I'd learned a lot, but my heart just felt like it was sinking in my chest. I mean, I just felt just paralyzed with overwhelm, you know, and then discouragement of the magnitude of the problems. And I just felt, well, I came home and said, wait a minute, if this is having this effect on me, then, and I consider myself, you know, somebody who's out there trying to encourage all of us, then this is not a good thing. And there's got to be another way to talk about, to think about these problems that allows us to feel our own power to make change. So I came home and just started, the first thing I did was bought a book on green economics, ecological economics, and started reading it. And I was just so disturbed that so much of the language was really not ecological. It was still trapped in what I considered then the mechanical worldview of, you know, just quantitative and the more or less frame rather than the networked frame of understanding. And I started trying to think of what might be a more empowering way to talk about these issues without in any way belittling the problem, but offering people a way of thinking about them. Because as you know, my work is so much about the power of ideas, and how we think about the problem is foundational to whether we can find the solution. Sort of the most important thing is, what questions are we asking and how are we thinking about it? Are they ways that empower us? Because I argue throughout that solutions are known. The real problem is that most people don't think they have any power to manifest those solutions. And I just felt that any speech or any book or anything that makes us feel more powerless was actually part of the problem, not the solution. So that put the fire in my belly.
How does one develop the courage to realize that we're not powerless, and to develop the courage to start thinking with an eco mind?
Well, the fundamental idea of eco mind is a shift from the world of, you know, the view of us as, you know, we're all separate from one another, that things are static in this world. There's just so much of given things, all separate from each other, and it's all scarce, that there's not enough. So there's this very scary world of separation and scarcity. So it's the kind of the S, I have three S's that describe it. Then there is the world of connection. And that is the world that we see when we think like an ecosystem, because what is ecology? It's all about relationships, that everything is shaped moment to moment through connectedness to all else. And so we're not alone. We're all just in this together with the plants, the animals, and with each other. In EcoMind, I say the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world, because every choice we make is one, because we're all so connected, we're modeling ourselves after each other. So we are influencing each other moment to moment by the way we carry ourselves. You know, are we expressing a sense of possibility, or are we just expressing a sense of defeat?
How does looking at things with possibility differ from looking at things with optimism?
I guess it's an important distinction to me, because optimism means that I can say that I can predict the future and I know that things are going to turn out a certain way for the better. And honestly, I don't know that. I only know that in an eco-mind perspective, where change is the only constant, and there's so many variables at any moment that are impinging, I only know that it's not possible to know what's possible. Would I have predicted even 5 years ago that we would elect an African-American president in this country? I would have given it a very small chance of likely success that that could happen. Or that... So at the end of the book, I talk about keeping a checklist of things that surprised you, that you would have given no chance of success, ahead of time. And so that keeps you in that sense of not knowing, because that sense of not knowing what's possible. And so therefore, why not go for the highest good? Because you can't say it couldn't happen if you really are humble in that bold humility way I'm talking about. Because it's this idea that we, until we try, we don't know. Because in an eco mind, there's so many things changing at once, and we don't know. Like right now, who would have predicted Occupy Wall Street? And who would have predicted that one of my highest goals is removing money from the political system in this country? And people say that's impossible. Well, now I know that it's not possible to know what's possible. And now a lot of people who last year weren't even talking about this, and I felt like I was a lone voice in the wilderness, now a lot of people are talking about how do we get money out of our political system. And it opens up a whole new conversation in this country.
Frances Moore LePay is the author of the new book, EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. In 1971, her first book, Diet for a Small Planet, was published. She is also the founder of the Small Planet Institute, and more information can be found at smallplanet.org. She talked to Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas earlier this month.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 23rd of November, 2011. It's the birthday of the poet and pop philosopher and historian Jennifer Michael Hecht, born on Long Island in 1965. Her latest book, The Happiness Myth, the historical antidote to what isn't working today, in which she argues that happiness is a phenomenon influenced far more by culture than by what we think of as scientific fact. She said, we think our version of a happy life is more like physics than like pop songs. We expect the people of the next century, say, to agree with our basic tenets. For instance, that broccoli is good for a happy life and that opium is bad. But they will not. Our rules for living are more like the history of pop songs. They make their weird sense only to the people of each given time period. They aren't true. It's the birthday of memoirist Ishmael Bia, born in Sierra Leone, 1980. He was 11 years old when a brutal civil war took place in his country, which eventually killed 500,000 of his countrymen. He wrote a book about it in 2007, A Long Way Gone, Memoir of a Boy Soldier. which told the story of how, after he and a group of boys from his village fled from the rebels, they were picked up by an army militia, plied with drugs, taught to fight with bayonets, and led into the jungles to do bloody battle against other bands of boys. He was 13 at the time. He was removed from the fighting by UNICEF, taken to a rehab center, then moved to New York City, where he lived with a foster mother, went to high school, and then to college. And it's the birthday of Neeraj Chowdhury, born 1897 in what was then Bengal, a region of British-ruled India. Made his career in journalism, in English. His memoir, The Autobiography of an Unknown Indian, was very popular in 1951, especially outside of India. And then his last book, Three Horsemen of the New Apocalypse. He wrote it when he was 99. He died 2 months shy of his 102nd birthday. Here's a poem for today by Samuel Hazo for Anna Catherine on Thanksgiving. The first girl in generations, you came when the century clicked from nines to zeros to plus one. Capped on a pallet, you flexed your toes and let us count your fingernails. We studied you as our particular event, our small surprise, our bonus. Months earlier, I prayed that you'd be born intact and healthy, and you were. Today, I wish you beauty, grace, intelligence, the commonplace grandfatherly cliches. What makes us crave for those we love, such bounties of perfection? Life, just life, is never miracle enough, no matter how we try to church ourselves. Squirming in my arms, you save me from my tyranny of dreams with nothing but your version of a kiss and the sure, blind love of innocence. For Anna Catherine on Thanksgiving, a poem by Samuel Hazo from The Song of the Horse, published by Autumn House Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith and written by Heather McPherson. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for KUAF is provided by the Malco Cinema Razorback Theater, featuring the Met Opera Live in HD, presenting Rodelinda on Saturday, December 3rd at 11:30 a.m. Tickets and more information are available on the web at malco.com.
This is Ozarks at Large, and Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF 91.3 FM. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Dean's Market.
Where is Dean's Market?
It is north of Alma.
North of Alma.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of Dean's Market.
Huh.
Perfect for the day before Thanksgiving.
Yes, because that's where you would get your turkey.
I would assume, maybe. I don't know if there's a market there. Speaking of Thanksgiving, is this a big holiday at the Grajeda House?
Yes, we've been planning on this one for a while. Mom starts making the menu weeks ahead.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Is it traditional turkey?
Oh, absolutely.
Pumpkin pie?
Yes, all of that good stuff. And more food than you can stand to eat.
That's what it's about, right? Yams? Do you have yams?
Are those the ones with the marshmallows?
Candied yams, yes.
I eat the marshmallows.
And then just push the vegetables aside?
Well, no, I just take the marshmallows off the top and just out of the pan, and then everybody else can have those if they want them.
You and I would be perfect Thanksgiving meal companions because I push the marshmallows aside and eat
That's the best part.
No, it's too sweet for me, too rich.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. You are missing out. Okay, so what do you eat then?
Well, I usually spend Thanksgiving with my wife's family, Laura's family, and they are very traditional. Okay. It will have turkey. We'll have stuffing.
Yeah.
We'll have potatoes and gravy, pumpkin pie. There's something they make that's called dragon's breath that they put on celery.
What is that?
I'm not sure.
Well, you don't. Okay, what do you mean you put it on like a like
it's a spread, and it goes in the middle of celery.
We just do peanut butter or cream cheese.
But you do that on Thanksgiving as well?
Yeah.
Huh.
Oh, yeah.
I'd never heard of really a celery thing on Thanksgiving until I...
Well, I mean, we do that any holiday, really.
Oh, okay.
But with celery, I don't know what dragon's breath is, but we put cream cheese or peanut butter
sure.
in it. Yeah.
But, yeah. We would do that as a snack growing up, but it wasn't necessarily a holiday related.
No, it's more of a holiday thing.
All right.
Yeah.
Do you watch football?
Yeah.
Macy's Thanksgiving Parade?
It depends. It just sort of depends on what we feel like at the time and who has a controller in their hand. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there's soccer on, we'll probably watch that.
Is there Thanksgiving soccer?
Depends on what channel you have.
Very good. Okay. Very good.
It might not be in a language that you understand, sir, but...
I gotcha. All right. Well, pleasant Thanksgiving to you.
Yes, and to you
tomorrow.
Guys too. Happy Turkey Day.
Thank you. Ify will be with me tomorrow for the Thanksgiving edition. You and I will be back Friday and we'll also be on Monday.
We will.
All right. Thanks, Antoinette. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
The song Almost Thanksgiving Day, Graham Parker from his album Your Country. This is KUAF. Have a happy Thanksgiving.